Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we'll be covering off all of the big news of the week, the arrest of Reality Winner. We also look at the supposed hacks against Qatar that have ratcheted up the political crisis in that region. And we also take a look at these renewed calls for internet companies to be more surveillance friendly. It's not just happening in Britain. In this week's feature interview, we catch up with Sami Kamkar to get his take on what the lowering cost of hardware-based hacking could mean for our increasingly automated world. And in this week's sponsor interview, we chat with Duo Security's Papayan Brienne about some recent attacks against the Mac OS software supply chain. Big thanks to Duo Security for sponsoring this week's show. They make all manner of kick-ass two-factor authentication technology. So go to duo.com to check out some of their stuff. Duo.com. This is the last show for a couple of weeks. I'm off to Indonesia in a couple of days. I'll be surfing, drinking a few bintangs, generally relaxing. So yes, blue teams, repent. The end is nigh. But let's get right into it this week. And Adam Boileau joins me now to talk about the week's news. And Adam, of course, one of the big news items this week, a young lady by the name of Reality Winner, which I'm sure is a story of its own somewhere in another podcast. Reality Winner, who is an NSA contractor, has been arrested for printing off documents and sending them to The Intercept, which is generally frowned upon when you're an NSA contractor.
Yeah, that's not so great. The Intercept ran an article based on the documents that she had obtained. One of them, the document that she provided was a report, a piece of analysis on an intrusion by the Russian GRU into a software provider that's involved with the US election systems, and then a subsequent onwards phishing campaign using material from that software provider towards people who worked in, you know, various kind of state and county election boards and that kind of thing. And you know, in that regard, I guess it was a fairly workaday sort of hacking campaign. The timing of it was interesting in that it was relatively close to Donald Trump's election. It was leaked, and then very, very quickly she was rounded up. And there's been a bunch of reporting around that in terms of assessing whether or not the Intercept's OPSEC was bad in handling it. They published a PDF which contained a scan of what appeared to have been at one point a paper document, and then she apparently was tracked down by looking at the people who had printed that document in the NSA. And that led to her, although apparently she had also emailed The Intercept from her work email account, which, you know.
Yeah, look, I went deep on this one. I read the affidavit. Apparently she was just requesting a transcript of a podcast or something. I don't think she was really in contact with The Intercept via her Gmail, but it looks like there was some kind of contact there. An interesting angle to this is that they were able to, everyone's been able to identify the serial number of the printer. When color laser printers first became a thing, the manufacturers had to do a deal with government where they would actually watermark every page with these little barely visible yellow dots. And that was really an anti-counterfeiting measure that was insisted upon by the US government. And in this case, those dots are visible and you can decode it using an EFF tool and actually figure out the model and, you know, like serial number of the printer. So it's OPSEC fails all around. People are blaming The Intercept for this. A lot of people are blaming The Intercept for actually outing their source by actually publishing the pages that she printed, which really made tracking her down a lot easier. It's hard to know necessarily whether or not The Intercept is really responsible here, though, isn't it? It's just impossible to tell whether or not they would have caught her anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you would certainly hope that their ability to track this kind of thing down has become, you know, should we say, well-honed over the last few years. I mean, they must have got much better at auditing access to documents and understanding who's got access to what particular documents. And there was some discussion that it was a relatively small pool of people who had access to it.
Well, I think access was wide, but there were only six people who actually printed it off. And this is why people are criticizing The Intercept, is because they scanned the documents that had obviously been folded to go into an envelope. So it was clear that they were printed on site. So they narrowed it down to six people. I've looked at Reality Winner's Twitter feed and she follows all of the alt US government accounts, you know, follows Edward Snowden, seems quite outspoken, a very outspoken opponent of Trump. So I don't think it would have taken the investigators too long once they had a look at the scan of the documents to figure it out. Whether or not they would have been able to figure it out this quickly or indeed at all if The Intercept hadn't have published scans of the physical documents, I mean, that's the bit that's hard to tell.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It is hard to say, although, I mean, you can't argue with the results. You know, she got rolled up real quick.
Yeah, and the sad thing is, I mean, this is a story that we've already covered. This is a story where the essential details have already leaked out. So this poor young woman is going to go to prison for quite a long time, having not really added much to the public discourse on this.
Yeah, that is kind of a sad aspect of the story. Yeah, I mean, as you say, like, the story is all very well in flight already, and this particular set of details, yeah, perhaps isn't that much of a big deal. It's funny that we can say that, you know, given how crazy everything is.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you're going to set fire to your life, you may as well make it, you know, mean something. And
you may
sadly,
as well go full Snowden, right?
Yeah, well, let's be careful about what we encourage there, Adam. Vladimir Putin, meanwhile, has been, you know, he's not blaming 400-pound hackers for all of this stuff. He's saying perhaps it's patriotic Russian hackers who may have interfered in the US election.
Yes, Putin compared hackers to artists who wake up in the morning in a good mood and just kind of start painting. You know, maybe they're patriotic Russians, you know, fighting imperialist aggression.
And how many hackers do you know who wake up in the morning
in a good mood? Yeah, not very many, I'll tell you that. That's probably because we have to write reports instead of doing actual hacking.
Just while we're on this, it's curious, isn't it, that the Russians were rattling around in some of these voter registration systems. I had a bit of an interesting conversation yesterday with Matt Tate over Twitter, and I'm like, well, why do you think they were in there? And a lot of people seem to think that it was so that when Clinton won, which is what everyone was expecting, they could feed the narrative of Trump having been sort of robbed of victory. And indeed, Matt pointed out Gucci Fatou's final post on the Gucci Fatou blog was saying, you know, you'll be hearing from us when we've got evidence of vote tampering, right? So it is really interesting pulling the threads of all of this together. So there you go. Staying with apparent, you know, alleged Russian hacks, there's a massive situation unfolding in Qatar at the moment. Saudi Arabia and a bunch of other countries have sort of, you know, more or less blockading Qatar, accusing it of links to terrorist organizations and whatnot. A lot of the one thing that's accelerated the crisis appears to be a fake news article actually published on a TV station website by intruders, by hackers. And these hackers now, apparently there's some media reports doing the rounds that say they were of the Russian state-sponsored variety.
There was some intrusion allegedly into this TV station in Qatar, and some, you know, quote, fake news, unquote, was published in a number of mediums. So there was there's a story about like a news piece on the site, and there's also a story about like a scrolling ticker on the bottom of the live video feed under an address by some, you know, bigwig from Qatar, which was making, you know, claims about their relationship with Israel and claims about their relationship with Iran and, you know, sort of generally, you know, firing things up. And that's, you know, getting into a position where you can alter whatever backing data is being used to generate those ticker feeds on live TV, I guess, is an interesting hack to go about. But yeah, the fact that that has, you know, been the thing that's sort of touched off the rest of, you know, of something else that's been brewing for quite some time. If that then points to Russia, that's an interesting story.
Yeah, I mean, the FBI have been over there in Doha having a look at this, right? And now we're seeing reporting from the likes of CNN saying, yep, this was Russia. Yeah, real interesting that the chaos continues, right? So we'll keep an eye on that one. And just, you know, I mean, I'm going on holidays for a couple of weeks, so who God knows what's next, but could be a tough few weeks for those in Qatar. Oh, now, in the wake of the terrorist attack in London that killed a bunch of people, including two young Australian women, Theresa May has issued a statement. Oh, she did a speech after the attack saying that we cannot allow the internet to be a safe space for jihadis, and perhaps there's some form of global regulation required. What's really funny about this is people have, it was one paragraph in her speech, and people have just inferred all sorts of crazy from that one paragraph, saying she's going to block Facebook and, do you know what I mean? Like, and censor everything and demand surveillance on everything. Really, we don't know what Theresa May is thinking other than Islamic State is using the internet and that's a problem, which seems like a fair enough statement.
Yeah, I think the statement, you know, of fact is relatively clear that, of course, they are going to communicate, and the internet is a very convenient medium over which to communicate. And, you know, whether or not they then correctly use encryption, and whether or not, you know, legislating that would change anything, you know, we really don't know. That is where it's going to go. But yeah, it has really been sort of whipped up into a froth all around the place, this you know, sort of ongoing discussion about the challenges of getting access to encrypted communications for law enforcement. Although in the case of the attack in London and some of the earlier ones in Europe, you know, we've seen stories where this is the initial narrative, and then as the story unfurls, it turns out that the particular people who carried out the attacks had been, you know, under investigation, or had been reported, or had some interaction with law enforcement already, and it's just the resources didn't exist to figure out what was worth, you know, what was interesting and what wasn't.
But there seems to be a common thread among all government. Now, you know, this debate has kicked off here in Australia as well. We've had some comments from Turnbull, Malcolm Turnbull, our Prime Minister. There is a big Supreme Court trial happening at the moment in Brazil relating to WhatsApp and whether or not, you know, they're going to basically let WhatsApp continue to operate in that country, or whether they're going to block it. So, you know, I think the common theme that comes up in these conversations is that governments feel that these companies are not responsive enough. They're not doing enough to moderate content on their own platforms, and they're not responsive enough to law enforcement matters. Now, look, I don't know if this is still the case, but the last time I checked, the only way to get data, user data, out of Facebook from Australia was to fill in a Mutual Assistance in Criminal Matters Act request, which would go from, say, the AFP to our Attorney General, to the US Attorney General, to the FBI, and then to Facebook. The turnaround time on those requests was something like 18 months to 2 years, okay, for a simple request. So when governments say that these companies aren't very responsive, that's what they're talking about. They are really unresponsive. I speak to people in DC. I speak to some of these national security advisors, and they tell me what these conversations, how these conversations go down with Silicon Valley executives, who basically just tell them, no, get stuffed. We're not going to help you. Something's got to give. And I sort of feel like, you know, maybe the tech companies need to come to the party a little bit, maybe cooperate a little bit more on things like metadata in the case of, you know, clearly, you know, when we're talking about terrorist organizations, and then maybe these crazy calls to, you know, pull out the regulation hammer might not go as far.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, you do make a very good point. I mean, the process of getting data out of these companies, especially when you're a small country like New Zealand, say, and your law enforcement wants to get data out of big internet companies, you have zero leverage whatsoever. And yeah, the process is very long-winded. And I think you're right. Like, if they do want to avoid a very large hammer of regulation, which will inevitably be blunt and doing the wrong thing because, I mean, the legislation won't match the reality of how the tech works, then yeah, they do need to kind of figure out something that's going to let them cooperate. And I think, you know, Google in some respects has made some steps towards, you know, being relatively cooperative, you know, more so than others, and doing so in a way that doesn't necessarily, you know, give up all of the details of their users, of the users' data, whilst still responding to law enforcement requests in a reasonable, you know, reasonable amount of time. But yeah, it's, you know, for something like WhatsApp, I guess, it's, you know, where you're talking about end-to-end crypto as opposed to talking about metadata or content stored on a platform like Facebook. Like, they're all very different kind of angles of the same basic problem, which is that law enforcement would like access to a bunch of stuff they don't have. But yeah, those are all different things that need to be treated differently, and they all have different sets of solutions. And I don't know that nuance is you know, well, that's, of course, is the problem, isn't it? That the debate ends up getting polarized and decided at the edges rather than in the middle, kind of where it needs to be, you know, to reach some kind of, you know, social contract about how these things should actually work. And you can see why there's distrust on both sides. But yeah, no, you're right. Like, we will end up in a position where, you know, we are forced to do things that just don't, you know, that don't make any sense from a technical perspective, because we haven't met them in the middle. Yeah.
Oh, Ross Ulbricht has lost his appeal, Adam. He is going to spend the rest of his life in prison. Unlucky for him.
Yeah, he attempted to make some arguments about the legitimacy of his life sentence on the basis of the, you know, Karl Marx force and the other guy who were scamming him whilst investigating him. And of course, they came back and said that, you know, those things really had no real bearing on the outcome of his case, or the fact that he was guilty of the things he was charged with. And they have upheld his life sentence whilst at the same time kind of making some noises about the general validity of the sort of very harsh penalties for people involved in the drug trade. So, yeah, he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison, it appears.
Bitcoin has still gone absolutely berserk. I think when I last checked, it was trading at $2,900 US, and Ethereum doing quite well also. But this has sort of renewed, a bunch of people out there are doubling down on trying to own people's various wallets out there. And there was a really funny tale of woe that someone wrote up on Medium about how someone social engineered their cell phone account, which let them reset their Gmail, which let them empty their Bitcoin wallet, and $8,000, bye-bye.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is an unfortunate side effect of the economics changing, isn't it? Value of Bitcoin goes up, and all of a sudden it's worth spending, the half hour it might take to, have the number ported to a different SIM card or something by phoning the telco and then take over the account and steal the money. And yeah, I mean, it does sound like there's been a bunch of attacks on users of the Coinbase wallet, online wallet scheme, to have their Bitcoin stolen through this kind of two-factor bypass. So, yep, it's, I guess, keep an eye on your Bitcoins.
Now, last week we spoke about this group of people who were going to crowdfund money to subscribe to shadow brokers to their monthly, data release. Turns out that when you consult your lawyer and ask them, hey, is it a good idea for us to raise money to buy stolen, highly classified NSA information from from likely a foreign intelligence service, turns out the lawyers don't really think that's a great idea. So that crowdfunding has been cancelled.
Yeah, they've cancelled their Patreon campaign to raise the money, and they published a statement. Apparently the lawyers do get very shouty when you try to buy classified cyber weapons from Russian spooks.
It's interesting, though, because, one theory that I hadn't thought of, someone put it to me the other day, is that the reason shadow brokers are making so much noise around these data releases is because they want to basically psych out the NSA and convince them that they have bugs that they don't actually have, to force NSA to disclose them to the vendors so that they lose that capability. Which kind of makes sense, right? I mean, that's someone serious gave me that theory, right?
It's crazy like a fox is what it is.
Oh, we got an interesting story here on Ars, which says that some of the APT crews in Russia are actually hiding CNC in Instagram comments. In fact, they actually used Britney Spears' official Instagram page, and they're embedding comments on there to use for CNC, which is, look, I mean, good malware writers have been doing this for a long time. And in fact, I remember talking to you about this something like 10 years ago when Immunity was working on something, basically a proof of this concept.
Yeah, and this kind of the use of legitimate domains for command and control traffic, or in this particular case, vectoring onwards to the real command and control server rather than embedding the actual command and control in the things, which is what the Immunity project that you were referring to actually did, where it used asymmetric crypto and put the commands in comments on blog posts and that kind of thing. But yeah, in this particular case, the malware is actually kind of like regexing command and control addresses, like bit.ly URLs, that are kind of hidden in comments on Britney Spears' Instagram page, which, I guess makes Britney relevant in a social media context. So that's nice. But it's a good way to make sure that on the perimeter of the network, when you're trying to spot, from a network perspective, command and control traffic, it really does look legit. It's going to a legit site, probably mirrors the traffic pattern of a real user. Maybe it's plausible that your users are browsing Britney Spears' Instagram page. Like, it's a perfect
That
perfect
should be a cover. Fireable offense for most organizations.
Well, you would hope, but, certainly around here, that'd be the case.
Hey, WikiLeaks has dropped another CIA tool, and this one's called Pandemic, and it actually looks pretty badass. I like this. What it does is, it sits on your FileShare server and, on the fly, infects stuff as clients go to grab it. So the file itself on the FileShare is never infected. But if anyone actually goes to grab that document, bang, there's exploitation. This is cool.
Yeah, this is it's implemented as a mini filter, so like a network layer filter driver that can modify traffic as it's going in and out. And yeah, doing real time substitution of files as they're being served is a pretty cool way to kind of serve up malware to clients whilst not appearing to be malware on the server itself, and of course also avoiding antivirus running on the server. So yeah, pretty neat trick. That's this kind of like in the middle inline. File substitution is obviously a thing that's very easy to do on other platforms that have kind of more flexible networking. On Linux, for example, this is a relatively straightforward thing to do you know, assuming that you can parse the network file sharing protocol in use. But yeah, interesting little tool. One twist perhaps is that I believe that that kind of driver does need to be signed to get loaded into the Windows kernel. So there is no suggestion in the documents that WikiLeaks have published about how, like, there's no example of you know, a signed instance of that in there. So if people find it in the wild somewhere, it would be interesting to know whose certificates signed it.
Yes, it would be interesting to know that, Adam. And that's a happy tip for you all out there. But I'm guessing, look, with all of this stuff, it's probably long gone by now, given that they know it's about to be burned. So you know. Good luck finding it in the wild. Ars Technica, and this one's kind of a little old now. This happened last week, but OneLogin. This is one of those SSO services online. You know, they got owned and a whole bunch of customer data got breached. I mean, the advice that they were issuing to customers kind of tells you, gives you an idea of how brutal it was. They're saying, you know, you need to cancel all your OAuth tokens and you need to, you know, change your passwords and whatever. They got worked over pretty hard.
Yeah, it does sound like they got pretty owned. And unfortunately, their messaging about it appears to kind of have changed over time, which confused it a bit more. And I don't know that they get the prize for doing the best response to this kind of thing, which when you're a security vendor selling secure login services as your main business, you really do need to get on top of this kind of incident really, really quick. And this isn't the first time that they've had bugs before. So,
well, bugs are one thing, but they got owned in this case, didn't they?
Yeah, they got proper owned, yes. So,
yes.
Yeah, it's really not what you're looking for in a single sign-on provider.
No, not maybe not so much. But it's not the derpiest thing that happened last week. Just after we put down the show last week, it turned out this defense contractor, it was booze, of course, right? Because that's just, it's booze. But apparently one of their engineers put a whole bunch of like geospatial intelligence in some open S3 bucket on Amazon, because that's what you do if you work at Booz Allen Hamilton.
Apparently so. And then someone found it, emailed the CISO of Booz Allen, didn't get a reply, then emailed the government agency in question, the National Geospatial Agency, who caused it to go away very, very quickly. And then several days
later.
Yeah,
it was like
later,
10 minutes or something, wasn't it? It was just like thunk.
And then, yeah, some time later, the Booz guy, you know, got back from playing golf or whatever and read his mail, or presumably got called by the NGA. And then, yes, things started to happen.
Yes, yes. So way to go, Booz Allen Hamilton, you know, sticking to form, gotta love it. Apparently, people are using Eternal Blue to spread all sorts of malware now, like garden variety malware. And it's interesting too, because someone's got it working on Windows 10. I think, you know, a few weeks ago we said, yeah, this will eventually work on Win 10. So yeah, not a real good time to be running unpatched SMB, right? But it was never a good time to be running unpatched SMB.
No, exactly. There was never a good time. So, yeah. I mean, hopefully with WannaCry, you know, raising the profile of this particular bug and the importance of filtering SMB and patching, this kind of infection will have less impact now than it would have, you know, in the pre-WannaCry period.
Checkpoint's done some really interesting work here. There's this Fireball adware, right, which belongs to a Chinese company, but apparently it's not exactly what you'd call high quality, allows for arbitrary code execution, all of the worst stuff, you know, that you just don't want in a tool like that. What makes this interesting is that there are 250 million PCs around the world with this software on them, so that's not good.
No, it's interesting to kind of compare this with, say, something like Configure, which, you know, didn't have an active malicious payload, but spread like a worm, and we treated it very seriously. Whereas this, you know, by virtue of spreading in a less, you know, obviously malicious way, you know, through bundled installs and whatever else, but it also doesn't have a, you know, a really clear payload other than redirecting people's search bars. The fact that you could use this for a whole bunch more, we ought to treat it with the same, you know, the same level of fear, perhaps, as we did something like Configure. But yeah, interesting that we don't, even though, you know, although actually, I guess now that it's been publicized a bit more, maybe someone will go and steal it off this particular Chinese, Raffertech is their name, this Chinese like search engine companies. Maybe someone will go and steal it off them and then use it for something else.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? You own these guys, you've just owned 250 million computers, and that's a pretty tasty botnet.
Yeah, well, exactly. Big target.
ThreatPost is carrying a story about IBM, a bug in IBM's backup stuff that was terrible. They'd known about it since September last year. There's only a workaround now. The only reason I mention it is because of that Veritas horror show that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. But geez, man, you know, vendors need to lift their game when it comes to improving the quality of their backup solutions.
Yeah, I mean, this one was particularly bad in that you read the password out of the registry as any user and then just connect to the backup server and restore the backups of the box, which includes, of course, the passwords and all the other sensitive things you can't actually normally read, and you've owned it, right? I mean, which is just, it's just ridiculous that an enterprise backup product is actually that untested.
It's just, I mean, that is just, you're smoking crack designing it that way. Like, that's just, you know, sometimes, like, there's flaws in code and you're like, okay, right, well, you know, shit happens, but in this case, it's just like, what were you on? You know what I mean?
Thinking that was a good idea. It's one thing to get Tavisode because, you know, your kernel, blah, 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 you know. Yeah. And it's another thing to just to
do this. Stuff the passwords into the registry and go, yep, awesome. apparently, 40,000 subdomains tied to this rig exploit kit, they've been shut down. It was kind of interesting how they managed to register so many domains. They just went fishing for GoDaddy creds and then just started adding subdomains to people's legit domains, which I suppose is a pretty handy way of running a massive amount of domains. It's a cheap way to do it.
It's certainly cheap. And also, I mean, you look at how many botnets are rounded up through looking at, you know, correlation between the Whois data and the email addresses and like tying the domains together. Like, that is a really good way to break up that particular, you know, attribution and correlation technique. So, yeah, and cheap as well.
Yeah, well, free, right? So 40,000 of them. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know as the legitimate domain operator that someone is running, you know, evil.attacker.yourdomain.whatever, right? So that, I just thought that was an interesting story. And also, we've got a survey here that has found that 53% of enterprise flash installs are old, which just makes me want to slam my head into the desk. Actually, it was Duo Security, who's this week's sponsor, who found that. But that's just like, oh, really?
Yeah, Duo is in a great position to kind of pull together that kind of stats, given that their platform collects that as part of the auth process. But yeah, 50% of flash out of that. I wish I was surprised, sadly. I've seen a lot of enterprise flash over the years, and it's always old. Like, they just never patch it. And for no good reason. It's not like it's Java where they need the old versions for some, you know, stupid bullshit corporate application thing. It's just flash. For God's sake, flash, patch it. But they don't. They just don't.
Well, mate, that's actually it for this week's news. Thanks thanks a bunch, Adam, and I'll speak to you again in a couple of weeks.
Yes, you're off on holiday and the world is going to get wrecked once more, I suspect.
But then we have so much fun talking about it when I come back.
We do. It'll be lots of fun.
Got to think of the positives, Adam. Got to think of the positives.
Yes, glass half full. We'll have great things to talk about in a few weeks when you're rested and everything is ruined.
Looking forward to it. That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Now, before we get into this week's feature, I do want to say, yes, the Risky Business Party is happening in Las Vegas the night before Black Hat. We have very limited ticketing for the event, so do keep an eye on my Twitter feed for the Eventbrite link. I am Risky Business on Twitter, one word. And I think we're like one meeting away from actually like pushing out that link, and this party will be oversubscribed. We have room for 250 people, and I'd guess something like 5,000 Risky Business listeners will be in Las Vegas for that week. So keep an eye out for the link and do get on it quick when I post it. Otherwise, you'll probably miss out. Okay, it's on to this week's feature interview now. And as regular listeners would know, I spent the week before last at the OSCERT conference here in Australia. One of the speakers at the event was Sami Kamkar. Sami is well known for his ingenious hacks, and he's also well known as being the author of the Sami Worm that took down MySpace in 2005. Oops. His talk at OSCERT was really great, actually, and you know, he did speak about the whole Sami Worm experience, and he just generally whizzed through his take on things in his talk. He spoke about how, you know, for example, he figured out that iOS and Android are both you know, sending location information from handsets back to base to help them build Google and Apple's geodata databases, for example. He spoke about a bunch of hacks he did as well. One of them was pretty funny, actually. He did some analysis of US credit cards and discovered that in many cases, there was actually a single bit on the mag stripe that would tell card readers if there was supposed to be a chip on the card or not. So if you just flip that bit, you could force mag stripe transactions with whatever card you had, which kind of made the chip redundant. He even built like this little electromagnet that could emulate the swiping of a mag stripe. So you could basically just hold this thing near a card reader to perform transactions, which was very Terminator 2 and very, very cool. And that's the thing. There are so many gadgets out there these days handling everything from our payments to transport to electricity metering to whatever. So as hardware and gadget attacks are getting cheaper, is it possible that things, you know, might just get a little bit out of control once we've accumulated sufficient technical debt? I spoke to Sammy at Ossert and started off by asking him if this chip bit on Magstripe still exists on US credit cards. Here's what he said.
Hopefully it's not the case anymore, but last I checked, yeah, it was just one major credit card company. And you could also predict those credit card numbers. I don't know if that's still the case anymore either. So if I were to steal your credit card and then I started using it, you noticed, you call your credit card company, you order a new one, so it stops mine from work, my cop mine from working that I've stolen from you. At the moment it stops working, I press a button on my MagSpoof device and I now have your next card number.
Yeah,
before you even get it.
It's beautiful, right? Because I can imagine you could just click that button, free parking for life, all of those things that don't require someone to verify a signature or actually check, you know, well, obviously you're not going to check a PIN, but, you know, you'd have a lot of fun with low value fraud, I'd imagine, sure. In that instance, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this is the thing, right? You were just talking about your little mag spoofer, which is cool to see in action. You had a video of it there, and it's like literally just bounces like magnetism around and, you know, makes things near it think that it's that you're swiping a card. It's very cool. But this has always been your bag, right? It's like these things that have an element of hardware. And a big theme of your talk was that these days doing stuff with hardware has got a lot cheaper, a lot more accessible, a lot easier. I remember speaking with Balint Sieber some time ago about the work he was doing with software-defined radio and about how that's this whole new world of attacks that's been opened up through this hardware. But it's not just SDR, is it? Like, there's so many things you can do when it comes to gadget hacking that might actually lead to real-world impact now.
Yeah, Balint's awesome. So he's always doing really cool work. There are other people who are always, you know, there's Michael Osman who's created the HackRF and Yardstick One. And so he's awesome. And there's, yeah, a number of other people doing really cool hardware stuff like Travis Goodspeed and you have Joe Grand and a couple others. So there's, I think hardware is super exciting because it's so low cost and accessible now. And for me, I personally focus on attacks that are low cost. I want anyone to be able to do this. I want to essentially even the playing field when it comes to offense. I think that's super exciting to me. And most of my tools, although I now have the luxury of being able to get expensive tools, I still use the low cost stuff so that when I release something, anyone can do it.
See, most of the listeners to this podcast, they are, you know, they're enterprise focused, right? And some of them kind of look at this stuff and they go, it's stunt hacking. You know what I mean? It's gadgets. Who cares? Like, what's the real world impact here when we look at it from a macro view, when we look at it from a systemic point of view, when we look about its impact on things like, you know, business and the macro view of information security, I guess. Like, what does that impact start to look like when you get further down this road?
You know, I don't have that high-level view. I'm probably not qualified to answer that. I'm just interested in what's the next thing I can do that works today, right? Works. It's very easy to implement, and I can actually go and attack machines, companies, consumers, whatever, and I can do that just right now. So I'm just interested in, like, what's next? What are the next attacks?
Yeah, because, I mean, the credit card thing, that's kind of quite relevant to fraud. For example, I mean, the Amazon drone stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, you wrote the software, of course, that lets you fly a drone around. It will hijack the other drones and make them fly in formation with your sort of master drone. Yeah. I can imagine that would have some relevance to Amazon, you know, now that they want to use drones to deliver stuff. So I guess what I'm getting at is I'm wondering if it is not just the availability of these types of cheap tools that'll allow you to attack, but you're going to be attacking often a lot of cheap things that are being used to do stuff like deliver pizza, right?
Yeah, I would actually argue that you know, some of the attacks that a lot of these things aren't necessarily attacking just cheap things. So, for example, the drone attack, originally it was for a Parrot AR drone, which is an inexpensive drone, but then I upgraded the attack and I made it work on DJI drones, and they have industrial drones. I made it work on 3DR drones, and they have industrial drones. So we're now talking $1,000 to $10,000 to $20,000 drones that are often, in many cases, if you're in, I live in Hollywood, they're often carrying $50,000 cameras underneath them. So you're now talking about real world drones that have, you know, recently there was a video on YouTube where there are terrorists actually showing, you know, using the same drones.
I saw a photo too of someone, they got these like big antenna things now that are like the drone killers. Right, like drone jammers are actually finding their ways into their way onto the battlefield in Iraq and Syria. So yeah, that one got real pretty quick, right?
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. So now there are a plethora of companies working on, and I'm talking, and large defense companies working some of which have actually used my open source software as bases and are now building on more and more drone types.
Does that comply with your license terms?
I don't think I license it. I actually don't have specific licenses, but I've seen a couple people using it, and I don't care. I don't mind, right? So far, it's been defensive, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, you're happy if your software is used to stop Islamic State dropping hand grenades on someone from DJI drones? Yeah, I can see that. I get it, right? If we look at a bit more of a logical extension, right? You know, we're talking about the case of drones. You know, we've seen you turn children's toys into garage door openers, things like that. You know, then we start getting a little bit further along in the Brave New World, and we start looking at autonomous trains, trucks, cars. We do see companies making substantial investments in security when it comes to things like self-driving cars, because that is that's going to be important, and that's a make or break business issue. But do you think, just from what you've observed, that you know the companies that are developing these new autonomous things are actually getting it right, or is it too opaque for you to know?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, I haven't played with autonomous stuff very much. I've been looking at some of the V2V and V2I, so that's the vehicle-to-vehicle and vehicle-to-infrastructure communication that's going on. So newer vehicles are actually communicating with other vehicles and with infrastructure around.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can have a lead truck, right? And you can have other trucks following that truck, and that's that semi-autonomous. And how do those protocols look and those implementations?
The only one I've seen, at least in the U.S., that recently was implemented was in Las Vegas, and they're actually using the cell phone network. There are other protocols, so I started looking at them, and I think once I can get my hands on a vehicle that's actually using this stuff, I'll be able to play with it a lot more. I'm looking at plenty of other car stuff, uniquely identifying vehicles based off other RF, tire pressure.
Tire pressure sensors are a good one, right? Because they've all got a unique ID. A lot of people don't know that, right? Yeah. So you can be super creepy by monitoring tire pressure sensor IDs as they go past. Yeah,
absolutely. And you probably can also just mess with somebody just by spoofing a TPMS and saying your tire pressure is, you know, super, super low or super, super high. You need to pull over now. And now they pull over and, you know, you can mount some other attack, whatever that may be. But there's other attacks going on, right? Obviously, a lot of these vehicles are using LiDAR or sonar and other types of sensors to take real-world information like GPS. And almost all of these are spoofable.
Well, see, this is kind of what I was getting at, right? When you start taking some of the SDR stuff that people like Balint are looking at, you start looking at the types of research that you're doing, and you sort of combine them and you just think, you know, even if they've got amazing authentication and amazing sort of AppSec, I guess, in these cars, and their binaries are all locked down and very well protected, how do you even trust sensor input in this world where just so much stuff can be spoofed and messed around with?
My assumption is that you can't trust any particular sensor, so you have to take a percentage of sensors, right? You just assume that at any given time, some of these sensors are giving you false information. So how do you have enough sensors where it's too difficult to spoof all of them?
Yeah, you can't provide false data to the, you know, the video camera as well as the this, as well as the that, as well
right.
as the, yeah.
Right, so I suspect that's how they will start solving some of these problems. But there's already videos and examples. I believe it was like Unicorn Team or Q360 Team who have demonstrated some of these issues, like with LiDAR and being able to spoof people in front of a car or not actually in front of a car, messing with Tesla's, some of their autonomy and... There's going to be
my favorite one was like someone who just grabbed a white spray can and sprayed two circles around a self-driving car, so it was trapped because it was double lines, couldn't cross.
Oh, that's awesome.
Simple stuff like that, right? I don't even know if it was just a joke, but I'd kind of believe it, right? Because that's not a situation it's going to encounter in the wild, right? So yeah. you could probably do some really like gnarly stuff around your neighborhood with some white spray cans,
I
think.
That's really funny. It reminds me of a video I saw on YouTube where it looked like it was in China. A girl's getting into her car and she drives just off a parking spot a little bit forward and then gets out of the car and then rolls up the parking spot. It was a parking spot sheet that she had printed out that she just puts down on the ground whenever she needs a spot. And it's just a little white marker that she just puts on the ground and then rolls up when she's done and drives away.
Beautiful. So, Sammy, how do you actually make your money, right? Because this is something that I'm guessing a few people might not know.
So all of those credit cards that I've been testing.
And we thought your criminal days were beyond you. I mean, do you do consulting on this sort of stuff? I mean, where does, you know, how do you make your living, I guess?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I'm fortunate that I I'm pretty passionate about the stuff I work on, so I'll often work on that stuff just with my own time, my own money. I'll release almost everything open source and free. And then sometimes, if I'm lucky, companies will come and say, hey, can you consult? We saw this project you did. You know, can we license that technology from you? Can we have you consult for us? So on and off, I'll do sort of small consulting projects or interesting research for various companies.
Yeah. And is it encouraging? I mean, are you getting the right people contacting you, or is it the case that you might publish something that has huge impact in industry X and there's just, you know, no one from that industry gets in touch and you think, oh dear, that's not a good sign?
I guess I don't care. I mean, the reason I'm not releasing this stuff to get contracts or get jobs. Yeah. If I cared more about that, I would be spending my time looking for that sort of stuff. I'm really fortunate that often, more times than not, someone will reach out to me and it'll be someone I would like to work with.
It's not hack stuff profit. It's just hack stuff, and then there's just the side benefit that you seem to pick up. Yeah, yeah, right.
That just happens.
Yeah, well, that's cool. All right, well, Sammy Kumkar, it's great to actually have spent some time with you in the flesh. Really good to meet you, and have a safe trip back, and thanks for joining us on Risky Business.
Awesome. Thanks, Patrick. It's been awesome.
That was Sammy Kumkar there. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Duo's security engineer, Papine Bruyenne. Duo is this week's sponsor, and they are experts in all things 2FA. And let's face it, everybody needs two-factor authentication these days, and Duo is the clear leader in second-factor authentication technology. So go to duo.com to check out some of their stuff. So Papine joins us this week to talk about a bit of a horror show that's been unfolding at Apple software developer Panic Inc. They make tools like Transmit, which is like a, you know, SSH file transfer utility. They also make Coda, which is for web devs. And they make a terminal emulator for iOS. And yeah, they got owned pretty hard recently. You may have caught the news that the video encoding tool Handbrake had its download servers compromised and the legit binaries were swapped out for Trojan versions. Handbrake is open source, so it wasn't too hard for the attackers to just add the Proton Trojan to the source, recompile it, repackage it, and throw it up on those download servers. Now, because Handbrake isn't signed, nobody suspected anything was off when they downloaded it, and there was just a bunch of ownage. The way they got people to download it was they sent a notification out through the updating service saying, you actually need to go to our website and download our latest version because the auto updater is broken or something like that. And plenty of people fell for it. One of the people who got popped this way was one of the founders of Panic Software, but an owned workstation was just the start of their troubles. Here's Papine.
He just honestly said, I just went through it and it installed. And quickly after, we got an email from the supposed attacker saying, we have a copy of all your apps source, and you know it's ransom time, and it's sort of like a different kind of ransomware almost. It's not the, you know, the red screen with the lock, you know, please to pay.
Did they actually do anything in terms of subverting or trying to subvert Panic Software in the same way that they'd subverted Handbrake?
Well, Panic said they quickly, you know, they did all the rotating and all the things that you would do as soon as you know a breach. They took the machine offline, but they have no way of knowing whether someone is doing that, right? Like, obviously, their internal systems, they said, were not affected. No customer data was affected. It was purely they got access to source code because this was a developer's machine that had a number of, you know, sensitive bits.
But if they're compiling from that source code, right, I mean, surely exactly. You can have a look at recent commits and things. I mean, that's one of the reasons you use Git. So I'd imagine they would have run a fine-tooth comb over the commits during that window, right?
As far as they said, yeah, they definitely did that. So they made sure that there were no sketchy looking commits. But at this point, the attackers do have, you know, sort of like a snapshot in time version of their code, and they can either, you know, pirate it, make it available for free. That seems, you know, I guess you could do that, but that doesn't necessarily seem like a great, you know.
It's not a moneymaker. It's just pissing in the punch, basically, right? You know?
Exactly. That's just making their life, you know, a little harder. But like you say, absolutely. Like whoever has this can easily compile, you know, more compromised versions of the same apps, start spreading them around. I mean, we've seen Apple's Xcode show up on Chinese sources with, you know, some extra, you know, special sauce in those. And that was also a very effective way of embedding, you know, malware in any app compiled with those versions. So you can see this sort of like, you know, snowballing. Once you get in that, if the developer of these apps just had a, you know, a moment of just sort of like getting through it, it's easy to imagine that, you know, regular users out there will be like, no, this looks good enough. This app, I need this, install it. And they won't even know for many, many, many days or weeks or whatever. And now it's obviously on panic to start chasing these things. So they say in the blog, they contacted Apple and FBI immediately to start chasing this. But it's going to be a bit of a goose chase, of course, because they don't know where this is going to pop up. So
it's tricky. If I'm them, I'm not so much worried. I mean, you know, software developers like them have survived pirated apps before, mm-hmm. right? Like it's not probably the existential threat it might have been once upon a time. People tend to be much cooler about paying for third party utils. But it does seem like the Mac target, like the Mac ecosystem and the supply chain is a pretty target rich environment because there are all sorts of little open source tools. I mean, I suppose it's the same on Windows, right? But Macs put you in that habit of just, you know, it's always throwing you password boxes to fill in, and you get certificate warnings on pretty much every single common tool.
It is.
That you're likely to use on OS X, right? Which is super weird. So do you think that this is, you know, a conscious decision by these attackers to sort of target that ecosystem?
I think so, because there's, you know, there's sort of the concept of like, you know, a dialogue or authentication, like apathy. At some point, you're just, you know, you just want to get to your email. You just want to get the thing done. Here's another thing that says warning, you know, site not trusted, and it's a tough back and forth, because, you know, developers like you have the Chrome team who want to make Chrome more and more like, you know, less accepting of sort of like loosey-goosey security implementations. Like, you got to get this right or Chrome will tell you this isn't secure. And I can understand that. But on the flip side, users get more and more annoyed by it and say, oh man, another dialogue. Yeah, I get it. Cool. Let's go through, which almost makes it like more likely that they step through something that was actually bad versus, well, this site is not, you know, not quite doing things right. Like, oh, they're still using a SHA-1 certificate. Yeah, we'll get to it in a couple of weeks. But you know what I'm saying? Like, it gets kind of tricky where the amount of dialogues that you get bombarded with to say, okay, do this. Yes, I agree to that. Type in your Apple ID once more, or on newer Macs, use your Touch ID to let this thing do what it's got to do. So it's a tough one. It's tough to balance that in sort of like a usable way. So I agree with you. Another thing, it's something that I recently actually blogged about because it really sort of annoyed me, is that Apple still gives you a very easy way as a malware writer to present very legitimate looking dialogues using the, you know, decades old Apple script, where you can say in one line, hey, Apple script, show a dialogue with, let's say, LastPass. Say, hey, your LastPass vault needs to be unlocked because there was a little problem. Just type in your master key here. All right, thank you. It will look very legitimate. It will have a LastPass dialogue. It will have a little icon. It will look very, very much trustworthy. Only it's not. Whoever popped this up had no business doing that.
No, I mean, you shouldn't be able to really do that, right? Like, nope. That's pretty shoddy. So I guess, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Duo Security sponsoring this show, I mean, I guess the relevance here is, you know, 2FA is probably a good idea when you're dealing with such a fishable sort of platform. I guess that's probably the message you guys want to get out there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, with a lot of these things, like if it all is happening on your machine, you can't really, you know, make that, call that a second factor. That's why if God forbid someone does get in your system, and you don't have to be a developer of a very well-known piece of software, you may just be working for your company and working on some source that's used internally, but you install this thing, someone gets your Git credentials, your SSH keys, all of that stuff. If there is no second layer there, you know, that's it, game over. So as soon as you get that 2FA thing on your phone or your watch, as we do, it will say, there's a request. Someone tries to, you know, get a Git pull going. It's like,
push notification, right? See, that's the thing, right? Yep. You know, I've had Git accounts before, and I've used just Google Authenticator, which is fine, right? It's just a random code generator. But I think, you know, the advantage really with Duo and the stuff you make is that if someone tries to log into your account, you actually get a pop-up on your phone saying, hey, you know, click approve to log in. And you're like, hang on, I'm out having a cocktail. This isn't right.
No, that's exactly. Yeah, we use the APNS, the Apple Push Notification Service to, yeah, that is our out-of-band, you know, our out-of-band facility, basically. So we're saying outside of all this stuff here that you have and are using what have you on it, we have your phone, and if you have one, a watch connected, we have that as an out-of-band facility where we can say, hey, someone is trying to do something with your Git credentials. Is this cool or not? And we, you know, we show things like where it's coming from, a location. We try to make it sort of like relevant to show, well, this is many thousands of miles away from where you are, to kind of give a quick overview of like, well, this is probably not legit, so let's deny that one. And then you can give like a reason why this is, you know, definitely legit. Or if you made a mistake, you can say, oh, this was a mistake by me. But generally speaking, when you see that and you're in a coffee shop and you are not anywhere near your machine, it's probably time to deny that and do a little bit of, you know, a little check on your system to see
I mean, you know, the nice thing about push is it kind of turns the users into like a type of IDS, right? Because I've got a bunch of friends who are pen testers and red teamers, and they fear push notifications, right? Because like that's what gets you caught. Were you surprised that these developers at Panic weren't actually using 2FA for their Git? I mean, this is a professional software house. I mean, it makes its money from those repos. Why wouldn't they protect them with 2FA? That just seems crazy to me.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, they wrote about, you know, this whole event, what they felt, you know, they could share. I mean, it might, but the fact that someone got on a developer's machine and was able through, you know, no further effort, get a code off a Git repo means there was, you know, at least, you know, a lack of security going on there. And, you know, again, this is not to blame anyone, because sometimes this just happens. I mean, I can totally see getting this and being like, well, looks legit enough. But luckily for me, I protect myself for that sort of like, you know, having a brain fart and being like, looks legit, by having 2FA on anything I use, so that it can say, hey, listen, I know you thought this looked good, but I have something different to say about it. So give that another thought. And then it's like, oh yeah, that's right, that didn't look so good. So
that said, I mean, look, you know, even if you're using a code generator, if you own the developer's machine, you can probably fish them anyway and just grab a one-time password and still get into Git that way anyway, right? Yep. Like what sort of 2FA would actually prevent you from experiencing those sort of troubles in that scenario? I'm guessing something involving UTF or...
Yeah, you know, we tend to kind of like give it like a ranking these days. So we say, you know, pretty much like SMS, if you can, just forget it. Don't do it anymore. You know, NIST is now sort of saying stop using that.
And yeah, more, well, we more saw a whole bunch of in the wild attacks quite recently, actually, against retail bank accounts using SS7. Yep. SS7 manipulation just for retail bank accounts. So, right. You know, that's done, right? It's cooked.
Yep. So use push. We definitely also, we support, you know, U2F for just about anything that we integrate with. U2F, you know, is sort of like, I would say at this point, the best thing you can do, because you have a hardware token, you have a presence, you know, you can do presence, like you have to tap the token to actually put things through. That is much more, you know, a much higher grade of second factor than a phone that can receive SMS, right? That is sort of easy to get around. Like SMS phishing is a common thing. Like anyone can do it without too much hassle.
U2F, right? I mean, the funny thing is I remember seeing like years ago papers on how APT crews out of China were actually bypassing smart card auth on DoD machines, right? So like even U2F doesn't 100% save you in the situation where the adversary owns the box that you're logging in from, but it certainly does make it a lot harder, right?
It does make it a lot harder. Like, obviously with U2F, the idea is that you don't keep the token connected at all times, and you definitely, like in the case of like YubiKeys and whatnot and other systems like that, that you require like physical presence, and they have like a little touch, you know, a little touch sensor on there that actually requires that you touch it. So generally speaking, obviously, you don't want to keep it connected unless you really have to. People can get lazy. But in general, if you have some sort of like physical presence proof built into your, you know, into your most of your tokens that you give out to employees or just for yourself, it becomes a little harder, because even if you're on the box and the token is plugged in, someone still needs to touch and, you know, approve the particular operation. And unless you happen to be bumping into it, obviously, while someone is working on that, I'm sure they could brute force and just keep trying until you accidentally, you know, throw a finger on there or, you know, whatever else. But
couldn't you start throwing them pop-ups asking for, you know, login details and then to touch their YubiKey? I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting at, right? Like at some point, you know, if you own the box, you're usually going to win, right? So it's great to... But I mean, this was too easy, right? So I'm totally with you that like using U2F and push would have probably prevented this.
That would at least given sort of the you know, the emergency brake, like, hey, is this what you want to be doing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because they were dealing with jerks, not state-sponsored, you know, spies, right?
Indeed.
Just a bunch of jerks. Okay, Papai and Brienne, thank you very much for joining us on the program to walk us through this Proton campaign affecting Handbrake and Panic Software. It's been a pleasure chatting to you.
Thanks for having me, Patrick.
That was Papai and Brienne there with a chat about Panic Software's woes. And it is a tale of woe that does reinforce the need for two-factor auth. If you need two-factor, you do just need Duo's stuff. So head over to duo.com to check out their tech. Look, in the end there, I certainly wasn't suggesting that two-factor isn't helpful. It is. I was more driving at the point that if an endpoint is compromised, then any authentication solution can only get you so far if you're authenticating from that device. But yeah, U2F or even push by itself would have absolutely stopped these attackers in this case. Running real-time attacks against UTF and push is pretty damn complicated. Also, do go check out what Duo is doing with Google in terms of providing verified access to Chrome OS. They're actually using the onboard crypto magic to verify system integrity as part of the authentication process, which is super, super cool. And I think, you know, this is definitely where we're going in terms of like future solutions, and Duo's right at the cutting edge of that. So I've dropped a link to that in this week's show notes. And yeah, that is it for this week's show, and that is it for Risky Business for a few weeks. We'll be back on June 28th, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.